And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello and welcome to the show we call Podcast UFO. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we're coming at you live like every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And if you're listening live, you can jump right over to the chat room at podcastufo.com. Well, I plan on being, once again, at the New England UFO Conference. Last year, it was a blast, and it is being held in Leominster, Massachusetts. It's on the night of October 17th, which is a Friday, and Saturday the 18th. And I will post a link to it on our website in the show notes. Stanton Friedman will be there, Kathy Martin, Peter Robbins, Mark D'Antonio, the Enos, and many more. Should be a lot of fun. And remember, I'm actually going to be upstairs in a room with the Enos. We're going to be sharing that, but I'll be out on the floor a lot, and I'll wear a UFO hat. So if you see a guy, I should be the only one there with a UFO hat. If you see a guy with a UFO hat, say hi to me, please. I'd appreciate it. Well, we have another great show for you tonight. Alejandro Rojas of Open Minds is coming right up with the news. After that, our guest, he wants to be referred to as Eric the UFO Agnostic. I heard Eric on another show a while back, and he's really looked into the UFO topic. He has a lot of really good points, and I assure you he will be a fascinating guest later on. So we're ready for the news. How are you, Alejandro?
Hello, I'm doing great. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. So what do we have going on this week for news?
Ooh, there's a lot going on. So I guess I'll start with the most exciting news going on right now. And that is some UFO sightings in Colorado and Utah, mostly in Colorado. At least that's where the most exciting stuff is going on, I think. But this is pretty cool. So the other day on 9 News, the NBC affiliate posted a story and some pictures of a UFO that one of their reporters saw. Multiple people had seen it. The police were called. The police said they saw it as well. And so what's really cool about this is that the reporter, Matt Renault, is like standing by what he saw. He said, "So far I've heard nothing that can really explain what I saw." He said he saw some shiny white dots that were in the sky. He watched them. They didn't move. And he kind of puts it, we watched them for 5 minutes or 6 and 10, 15. And then finally, they kind of flashed and then moved off very quickly above the mountains. So he's like, I don't know what would do this. This is really strange. This is really something extraordinary. So they talked to the police. The police said, we saw them too. This is some wild stuff. And then they also called NORAD. NORAD said that we haven't registered any anomalies, but we are investigating. So, and the story concluded that the sheriffs were investigating also. So really cool. However, another story came out from the local paper, from the Summit, I think it's a Summit County paper, the county that Breckenridge is in. And they said that police said they aren't investigating. They also called NORAD, who said they aren't investigating. They both just said, the police said we saw it, but, what are we supposed to do? And NORAD kind of was similar. They didn't register anything. So
that's probably closer to the truth.
Well, and what are they supposed to do? Saw it so it's hard to say. This is what's frustrating, though, and I ran into this in the very first UFO case that I ever investigated. They called the FAA, and the FAA says, well, we're not in the UFO business. We're in the air safety business, so call New Fork or somebody that, is monitoring UFOs, which is absolutely ridiculous because they're monitoring air safety, but they don't want to know about unidentified objects flying around in the same airspace as commercial aircraft. And that makes absolutely no sense. I think that's really frustrating, but that's what they told the Summit County newspaper. Pretty cool stuff, a great case, and now it's starting to go viral, and it's being reported all over the place.
Now, this there is no chance that when you say it moved off in a high rate of speed, too high rate of speed to be a drone of any kind? Because I know the drones can, you know, they can hover in one area.
That's true. A drone can't do this. These look pretty high, you know, and then it zipped off at probably, I mean, it would have to be a large drone, maybe some sort of military type of thing. And plus, it was shiny and visible like a dot. I mean, these things look like a dot in Colorado. In fact, I've seen these things in Colorado. Two of my UFO sightings have been of very similar things. And when I was a MUFON investigator out there, we used to get a lot of this. So it's hard to say. I mean, I guess it could possibly, but that's what's hard these days, you know. And one of the other papers covering another story, the Hong Kong one, kind of says drones really screw up UFOs. UFOs are screwed now because of drones. And I think we've talked about this before.
Yes, we have, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because anything can be drones at this point. So it's hard to say because drones are very maneuverable. And you can appear as metallic, shiny things in the sky. So it's really tough to say.
So what else is going on in the news?
This is another story that's kind of hitting the, at least the UFO world, not so much hitting mainstream as much. This is a sighting in Kansas where the witness caught two UFOs on a photo. Supposedly, allegedly, and it was actually submitted to MUFON from a friend of theirs who said this called the picture amazingly clear. The objects in question, one of them definitely seems to be, because it's taking a picture of the sun, it appears to me to be a lens flare, which mm-hmm. happens, you know, when you're taking a picture of the sun. However, there's another object that is kind of kite-shaped that is more mysterious, which is kind of weird in this picture. One of the problems pointed out by Robert Powell, who is the MUFON Director of Research, when we posted this on Facebook, he said he noticed, well, the picture's really small. It's only 60K. So this must be a crop or just a tiny, somebody's manipulated the image to make it smaller. So it's a little bit suspicious in that the picture has been manipulated, but it's certainly not the original. And he notes that, you know, we'll really need to take a look at the original to make anything out. But it's kind of making its rounds out there, and it's been one of the more popular stories this week as well.
Yeah, right. I think I saw that picture. It looks like almost like a triangle. Something like a triangle. Okay, and what's the last story for this evening?
The last story is one I want to talk about. It is making rounds in the mainstream media, but luckily at Open Minds we have a little bit more insight into this story because we've been covering it, and we've had one of the scientists as part of this team at our conference last year, and he made some pretty incredible news that actually Lee Spiegel of Huffington Post wrote up about, and it made a lot of news in the mainstream. And that is this group of astrobiologists. One of them talked to the Daily Express in the UK. And there is this group of astrobiologists out of the University of Sheffield and the University of Buckingham Center for Astrobiology who say they have an abundance of proof that extraterrestrial life exists. Now, they said this a year ago. They've written papers here and there to talk about it. We had Richard Hoover, who worked with NASA for 46 years, and he also started the Center for Astrobiology at Marshall Space Center for NASA. Mm. So, and he says, you know, the same thing. Essentially, what they were talking about are meteorites that look like they have, you know, microorganisms in them. Mm-hmm. And they are convinced that these are microorganisms. Even the meteorite from Mars, you know, that made a lot of news when Bill Clinton came out and said we found ET life. And now skeptics have said, well, maybe not so much. About a year ago, they had made these claims because what they did was send some balloons up into the stratosphere during the Perseids meteor shower. And these balloons had devices on them that opened up once they got to the stratosphere, exposed these slides to the atmosphere, then closed up. And these things were sealed so it would come back and see what was in the stratosphere. At the time, they said they found objects which they believed were microorganisms. They argued there's no way they could have got up there, and commonly believed that nothing can get up into the stratosphere from the Earth, not even microbes. So that was their argument. However, in this recent interview with another one of the scientists with the Daily Express, he talks about how now they even have more evidence from the data they collected there. They have something called a Dragon particle, which is a biological entity, they say, some sort of microorganism that is not here on Earth. The other arguments they make is that when they exposed those slides, they didn't get dust or anything else but these microorganisms. So in other words, if there is something, some way, volcanoes or wind, that took all of this stuff into the stratosphere, why did it only take these microorganisms? Why aren't they seeing other things? How did they get filtered out? So that's another, I think, a great argument that they make that, you know, supports that this is actual extraterrestrial life. One of these guys is the guy who came up with the idea or helped come up with the idea of panspermia, and which they believe. And they're essentially saying this is more evidence that, you know, life is abundant out there and it's traveling from planet to planet via meteorites and asteroids. And this demonstrates that it's literally raining down on us. And another reason that this story is timely, of course, is because Russian scientists recently said they found plankton on the ISS.
That's right.
And he's arguing, hey, that thing's 200 miles away. There's no way something from Earth blew up there onto it. Just like our findings in the stratosphere, it's very possible these are space-borne, you know, microorganisms that had attached themselves to the ISS. So really, really interesting stuff. And their evidence is just building and building and building. And I think it's really exciting because you know, it's kind of like for a while now, I don't know how you feel, we've been on the cusp of an official announcement of the discovery of extraterrestrial life.
Right.
And you have these astrobiologists, including Hoover, who, you know, Lee Spiegel did a video interview for us that we've posted in the story where he talks about this is real. It's been real for a long time. It's just taking the scientific community a while to accept it. But I think soon they will, and I really think that that's a big deal for our field because once people realize there's life and it's abundant, it's as close as, you know, in the space just outside of our own atmosphere that it makes it highly more likely that there are advanced civilizations out there as well.
Could be just floating around space in general. You know,
exactly.
That's pretty amazing. You can go to the show notes and find the links to all these stories that Alejandro has just mentioned. We'll see you next week, Alejandro. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Mm-hmm. So hang in there. We'll be right back after this short music break with Eric, the UFO agnostic. I should mention that music is, like all our music, by Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse. He writes music for the show, and thank you for that, Carrie. And our guest, Eric, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks for joining us, and I mentioned earlier that I heard you on another show and really enjoyed listening to you. A lot of valid points, and I know you want to remain anonymous, but is there any part of your background that you can sort of throw out there?
Sure. I have a background in organized skepticism in terms of being one of the co-founders of a skeptic organization back in 2000, which was at the time designed to be a national, an organization of national scope, whose purpose was to launch as many skeptic groups on college campuses as possible. And so at the time, there were a few dozen groups like that around the U.S. And last count, I think it's between 350 and 400 groups like that. So I've had an interest, I guess, from the skeptic side in a lot of paranormal things for quite some time, because I find the question about the border between science and, I guess you could say, anti-science, maybe, if that doesn't sort of prejudice the debate in the assumption, to be a very interesting kind of discussion. So I guess that's part of my background that's relevant to this.
Uh-huh. And, you know, I don't mind a skeptic. It's when someone is a skeptic just by proclamation only, and there's more or less, you know, just debunking and debunking without even looking into it. And after I listened to your show, you could tell you really looked into the subject, and the people will, I'm sure, feel that way as we talk later more about this. So what is your you more or less think it's possible, right, that we could be being visited? I mean, you're not ruling it out.
No, absolutely not. And one of my main critiques of skepticism with regard to the UFO question is that I think you can identify a kind of metaphysical and also psychologically hidden rejection of even the possibility that there could be beings from other, you know, parts of the cosmos here. I would consider myself an agnostic, but even leaning towards the possibility, if not likelihood, that some of the cases might be best explained by the extraterrestrial hypothesis. But, you know, I don't feel any kind of inner sense of certainty about that. But it's quite a transition from where I began, because I began, you know, like many other skeptics, reading Skeptic magazine, Skeptical Inquirer. And as long as you don't step off that plantation and do a bunch of other reading and talking to people, you're very much apt to get the impression that the whole field of ufology is of the same credulous, uncritical fabric as are a lot of other questionable beliefs. But there are a few things that I read that really made me rethink that, and it's been sort of a unsettling journey to think that I guess the scientific establishment could possibly be just radically wrong about this question.
Mm-hmm. You know, the topic's come up many times. Why doesn't science, you know, take this seriously? And you know, a lot of it's very fleeting evidence for the most part. There's no money. And the best explanation I heard of why science doesn't get involved was from a previous guest, Jeffrey Bennett, who is an astrophysicist, and he basically said the reason science doesn't get into it is because it's not a quick problem solved. Most people that get involved in science and want to get funding, they want the quick problem solved so they can actually get the funding for it. And so I understand that, but what is your feelings about if there was actually funding for research? Do you think scientists, or at least some of them, would look at the subject a little more seriously?
I suspect yes, although I'm just sort of going on general background information about how people in general that I've read about respond to this. And I guess also in particular, I'll add that if I could switch this just for a second to the realm of, psychic power, telekinesis, and so forth, I'm still fairly skeptical about that, but I have heard people who've been involved with that they will get contacted by mainstream academics who say, you know, don't tell anyone that I'm contacting you, but I'm actually really interested in this, and I'm not so sure that what you're up to is, you know, completely mistaken. So I suspect that's the same for the UFO question. You'd have to assume that, you know, there would be some percentage of people who would be more than happy to accept a grant to take a look at this. That's my read of it anyway.
And what do you say to the skeptical quote that I hear many times is there's too much distance for any interstellar travel. It would take too long. Are you open-minded in the area of the fact that they may know something about physics that we haven't discovered yet?
Yeah, and I think, strictly speaking, you have to be open-minded about that because if we knew the answer to every scientific question ahead of time, then there would be no point in the scientific process. But there's a great deal that we don't know. You have to assume that, you know, if an intelligent civilization, you know, had managed to get past what might be a, you know, universe-wide threat of nuclear annihilation and resource use overshoots and pollution, et cetera, if they were to get past those kinds of bottlenecks in their development, and assuming a similar technological trajectory to where we're at, you know, 500 years, which is pretty modest, but what about 100,000, a million, 10 million? it's entirely possible and even likely that their understanding of the cosmos is much further along than ours. It strikes me as a kind of parochialism to think that whatever we know right now pretty much has to be determinative about what people 1,000 years, you know, might know. We've been demoted too many times in our quest to understand ourselves in the universe, and it's entirely possible that will happen again. So I think it's best to keep an open mind about that possibility.
Now, a lot of people don't really even think about this unless they have had something happen or it gets put right in front of them. What made you look into this subject? And when I say that, I mean, just say the average person walking the street, very few people even think about extraterrestrial life. Maybe a little more now that it's in the news a lot, you know, with the exploration we're doing. But what made you actually look into this particular topic?
Well, like I said before, I've always been interested in the paranormal in general, but specifically with regard to the UFO topic. I think this stood out for me because I didn't have a theoretical, I guess you could say, stopping point. There was no theoretical reason why, other than the great distances involved, that some UFO sightings, you know, couldn't be from someplace other than Earth. And to me, this has always differed from other paranormal-type questions, you know, like ghosts, let's say, or Bigfoot, psychic phenomena, etc. With these other areas, there seem to be too many theoretical reasons to think that they probably don't exist. But I retain an open mind about those as well. But with this one, in a way, I'm almost surprised that, you know, sometimes that, you know, a giant mothership hasn't landed on White House lawn. The only real theoretical issue here is, you know, the great distances involved, it seems to me. But there were a couple things that really sort of started turning me in this direction. I think the first thing maybe was there was a book that came out in 1998 called Dancing Naked in the Mind Field by Kerry Mullis. He's Nobel Prize-winning chemist, Quite an interesting fellow, sort of idiosyncratic and a free thinker. And in one chapter of that book, he reported a missing time episode. He was at his cabin in Mendocino, California, and he was walking on his property, and as crazy as it sounds, and it does sound crazy, he said that a raccoon said to him, if I remember correctly, good evening, doctor. And then the next thing he knew, it was a whole bunch of hours later, and he was at a different part of his property, and he was walking back toward his cabin. And he found that a very disturbing experience, as anyone would. But the thing that struck me about that was, if it was just him reporting that, I would think, okay, who knows what happened there? Could be a psychological issue. He talks about having taken LSD in the past. Maybe there was some issue there. Who knows? But then a few years later, he got a call from his daughter. And his daughter said that she was on the, at his cabin with her boyfriend. And she went missing. And her boyfriend was looking for her, and she didn't know where she was, apparently. And she found herself making her way back to the cabin from a similar location where Carrie Mullis did when he went missing. So I didn't know what to think of that, and the chapter was not meant to be an exhaustive examination of that particular case, but it struck me as really weird, and I sort of trusted his testimony. So I thought, huh, that's really weird, and I don't want to prejudge it. I'll just sort of put that into a, who knows category. A couple years after that, a few years after that, I read Stephen Greer's Disclosure. Now, I don't have a high degree of confidence in Stephen Greer's methodologies, but I found that book unsettling, I guess you could say. I, like a lot of UFO books, I wasn't really convinced that it was an adequate examination of a lot of the witnesses. There's just too many questions that seem to be lying on the table that weren't asked. But you read a book like that and you think, okay, what's going on here? A, is it the case that everyone is mistaken? They're just, in some cases, just wildly mistaken about things they've seen. It's possible, I suppose. Another possibility is that maybe they're all hoaxing. All of those people hoaxing would be highly unlikely, it seems to me. And the last possibility would be, well, maybe they did see something that's unexplained, and maybe some of those things that are unexplained didn't come from Earth. So I couldn't fit that book into a closed skeptic box that would sort of allow me to put a bow and tie on my view of the universe and say, okay, explained, next. That really sort of stayed with me. What I found was also very interesting was I gave this book to a friend of mine who has also played a role in skepticism. He's a very, very smart guy, one of the smartest people I know, and encouraged him to read it. We got together a few weeks later, and he had basically come to the same place that I did, I think, which was from a place of skepticism to a kind of, well, I just don't know. It could be possible. So those are two things, and I'm not sure if we should go into this or not, but I had an experience when I was about 9 years old that I sort of tucked away, and it didn't pull out again until I was, probably back in college, and that's been a real puzzler to me ever since.
Can you describe that encounter?
Yeah. Late 70s, southern Wisconsin, I was visiting my grandparents' farm with my family. We'd go down there a few times during the summer. I think a Saturday morning, my brother and I, who is 2 years younger, we left the farmhouse. And this is pretty flat farm country. You can see for great distances. And we were walking out to the farm field, as we typically did, probably intending to get in trouble that day, and happened to look up, and I saw what looked to be something the size of the moon, but it wasn't the moon. And it was moving very noticeably down. So it was maybe about 60 degrees up, and it would be moving down for a few seconds and then completely disappear and then reappear again a little bit lower. And it was a disk. It had a uniform color. It was sort of a white with maybe a little bluish tinge to it. And so it was doing this for about 10, 12 seconds, and we both stood there transfixed. I don't think either one of us could, by any stretch of the imagination, be said to, have had any expertise in, aircraft identification or anything like that. But I did have an interest in airplanes at the time, and I have a pilot's license right now. So I was the kind of kid who would look up and see things, but this just... it didn't fit in any kind of category that I could imagine.
Now, did you hear any? So we started yelling. Pardon me. Did you hear any sound at all?
No, it was perfectly silent. And there was a sort of a finale to it where it got maybe about 10, 15 degrees above the horizon, and it appeared to rotate, like if you had a plate, like a paper plate in front of you, and then you started to rotate it. And so it goes from a circle to being an oval, and right when it got on its edge, it disappeared for about a second, and then something sort of looked like it fell from it that was sort of a deltoid kind of shape, and it went beneath the horizon. And, of course, my grandma, came out after that whole thing happened. There's a couple of things I told myself after that. One is that I could have... just memory is fallible, and I could have, misremembered over time. I could have added details. And I thought, well, maybe it was a weather balloon, but I can't seem to make that exactly fit. So it's an unknown, I guess, to me.
When just to change the subject just for a second, we'll jump back to that. But as a skeptic, since you were involved in the Skeptic Society, why would you think that so many people just plain debunk? And I've listened to a couple skeptic shows, and they're like, "Oh, come on," that type of thing. Instead of the way the skepticism is supposed to work is critical thinking. Am I right by that? And can you describe, to the listener, what a skeptic really should be compared to what a lot of them seem to be? And by the way, if you're listening live, you can jump in the chat room, ask our guest a question at podcastufo.com. So go ahead, if you would, describe what a true skeptic is supposed to be.
Well, I should say that I wouldn't want to paint the entire skeptic movement with the same brush. I think there are plenty of open-minded people in it. But one of the problems is that many of the elites within that movement, they tend to be, I think, sort of dogmatic on this question. A true skeptic follows the evidence. A true skeptic is aware of one of the greatest distortions in human psychology when it comes to epistemology and trying to determine the truth of something, which is confirmation bias. Ironically, as much as that particular term might come up in skeptic literature, it's still possible to identify skeptics who run roughshod over the caution that human tendency gives us, when we're trying to engage in, some kind of contentious issue. So, a skeptic is not... an a priori debunker. A skeptic is someone who keeps an open mind and engages in a process of self-criticism in addition to, the necessary criticism of, claims to truth.
Okay, that's good. A question came up on the message board, and the person wants you to explain where you think the hardcore skeptics are going wrong.
The first thing I'd say about that would be that I think that they have a kind of, I would put it as a metaphysical commitment to the idea that we can't be being visited by ETs. Now, saying that is sort of a strong statement. How would I justify that? How would that work? I don't have a complete theory about that, but it seems to me that despite, you know, the ready admission of many skeptics that, sure, it's a huge universe and, you know, evolution is a natural process, and as was discussed earlier in your program, you know, it's very likely that life is seeded everywhere and there's intelligent life, quite possibly a lot of it, even in our own galaxy. Despite that, the possibility that there might be some kind of other civilization that is very far ahead of us, I can't help but wonder if that is just a real threat on multiple levels. So I guess maybe that's what I'm getting at, is that this is a kind of threat. The threat manifests in terms of just the threat would pose to our identity as humans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you assume that, let's say, some extraterrestrial civilization is 10,000 years ahead of us, they may very well have powers of manipulation over matter, manipulation of their bodies and their minds and technology, such that it would really pose a kind of ontological crisis, if you will, identity crisis for humanity, to know that that could very well be in our future, and that almost everything we assume about ourselves, we have to toss out. So I think that's one aspect of it. Another is a kind of self-referentiality within academia, within science, within sort of official culture. It's sort of assumed that UFOs of an ET origin are just, you know, the product of people who are sort of naive, who don't know what's going on, people who in other contexts would believe things that we just can't take seriously. And as a consequence, you know, if that's sort of a given truth, then it's not really a matter of evidence so much as it's a kind of psychological block, it seems to me. I mean, one example of this, there was an article in the Daily Mail from a couple of weeks ago, maybe some of you saw that, and it looked like a lenticular cloud, but the people who took the picture of it said, no, that's not the case. It was moving way too fast. And quoted an academic who looked at it and said, well, it can't be from elsewhere because those distances are too great. And once you say that, then that presumably just shuts down the argument. Well, distances are too great, end of discussion. So, I think that we can't look to evidence for the reason why there's a kind of dogmatism among official intellectual culture. It's really sort of a psychological thing. And I think if you were to sort of comb through enough statements by skeptics, you would see that. And we could have a big discussion about how that manifests.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the things you think about the human, you know, We're fallible. Fallible as far as being witnesses. And it's kind of amazing when I listen to your sighting, because it was actually very similar to mine, which actually changed my life and is the reason this show is going, right down to the bluish tint, the hue that it had. That's in, you know, no sound, et cetera. But as far as witnesses go, and as far as eyewitnesses go, you know, I had a debate with Seth Shostak from SETI a while back, and he said that the human witnesses, eyewitnesses, mean nothing. And what is your stand on witnesses?
Well, first I'll say that I'm very appreciative of the research that's been done on problems with human perception, estimation, judgment, memory. These are very real things, and they can distort what people see. However, there's a kind of implicit artificial distinction that's made by skeptics, and this is another reason why you might find a lot of dogmatism. And that is, on the one hand, there's testimony of extraordinary UFO claims, and there's the kind of testimony that is part of the rest of life. And the testimony that references UFO claims is given extra and asymmetrical scrutiny, whereas the testimony which pervades the rest of human experience doesn't get quite that attention. Another point about testimony is that science depends on testimony. Every single observation that's made by a scientist doesn't magically extricate itself from the possibility of failure or misperception. That's also an observation, and when that scientist then records the results, that's a form of testimony. Scientific journal articles, that's a form of testimony. There are many points along the route to getting that published where there could be mistakes, and of course, no one assumes that, you know, just because something shows up in a scientific journal that it's infallible. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really a failure to appreciate just how dependent we are on testimony in all aspects of our lives, including science. Science is really no different. But the virtue of science is that it recognizes that and says, well, okay, we could be wrong. So here's my experiment. I'll write about this. Now, someone else do this, too, and see if you get the same result. So I think it's an unequal treatment of the role of testimony in human life.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know how much you've looked into this at all or if you've ever looked into it, but what's your opinion on, at least at some points here and there, the government covering up, say, things in regards to the UFO topic?
You know, I go back and forth on that one. After having read the first volume of Richard Dolan's two-book series on the national security state and UFOs, you're left with the overwhelming impression that there are people who have to know something. What they know is, of course, the question, and I wouldn't even really dare to speculate on that. But it seems to me that someone somewhere, maybe some people, maybe there are some files, touch on this topic and may have some extra information that we haven't been able to get otherwise. But I wouldn't want to say much more beyond that, because I find that whole question sort of impenetrable. And I think a lot of people do who have looked at them.
Mm-hmm. We have a message up on the message board. And I'm not sure what you're going to think about it, but is it possible the modern-day skeptical community has its roots in the attempt to cover up the truth about UFOs known by certain people in the government? That's up on the message board.
Let's see. Howard Menzel was, a notorious skeptic. Carl Sagan was a skeptic. You know, I guess my take on that would be that it's sort of a common saying in the sort of skeptic free thought community that trying to organize skeptics is like trying to organize, cats. You know, there are so many, opinionated, free-thinking, very critical people who, you know, if you look at some of the popular free thought skeptic, even atheist blogs, the discussion there can be very rancorous. So the idea that there's maybe a kind of governing authority of skepticism that sort of keeps the lid on things, I would completely reject, because there are too many people who just flat out are anti-authority within skepticism. If they smell a rat, they're going to go after it. They're definitely not a, in many instances, they're not a lock and step kind of group.
Mm-hmm. You think of the person that comes to mind as far as skeptics go is Philip Glass. Yeah. Are you familiar with him?
Somewhat.
A lot of people kind of thought there was some a little more than just his opinion going on there. He raised a lot of eyebrows in a lot of different communities, not just the UFO community, of course.
Yeah.
If you were to compare the UFO topic to other, you mentioned paranormal early on. Do you think it's one of the more believable topics? I don't know if that's the right word I want to use, or one of the more credible topics for a skeptic to actually take note of?
I think it is. And I think for two reasons. One is just the theoretical reason, which is despite the great lengths of distance involved, everything else sort of points to the likelihood of there being intelligence. And those lengths also have a flip side, which is huge amounts of time for probes and self-replicating machines and spacecraft that maybe contain embryos that could be grown in a artificial womb, etc., once they arrived on target. So theoretically, I don't think it poses a huge problem at all for skeptics. It shouldn't. And, I think I forgot my second point. But that's probably the main thing for me, is I don't think there's any huge theoretical problem for skeptics to pay attention to this. Oh, the second point was that, once you look into enough of these cases, it becomes really difficult to accept that, everything is a misperception or everything is a hoax. I mean, I still sort of hold out that maybe that's the case, but I'm increasingly less confident that those are, the sort of conclusions that can be drawn when you look at things. There's just a lot of weird things that have happened that just sort of defy explanation. And I wish more skeptics would take the time to dive into the available resources.
Now, do you know any skeptics personally that actually kind of share your thoughts and interests in the subject?
Aside from the friend to whom I handed the Greer book, Disclosure, I don't know of any other skeptics who share my exact point of view. I have to assume that they're out there, because I've met plenty of skeptics who are just, they're so down to earth and so reasonable about so many things. It would surprise me if others weren't like that. But as I think we all know, they're typically not the ones who are, the publishers of the magazines and the ones who are invited to speak at conferences.
Yes, I understand that. And speaking of conferences and alike, the UFO community. Now, there's some people that are way, way out there and understandably attacked by the skeptical community. And Greer is actually someone that I've attacked on this show a few times. But in general, when you're out there and you're talking, skeptics are talking about the UFO subject, Does that come up a lot of these, the people that are just plain whacked out there that are fringe?
Yeah. In fact, I sort of have a sense that they're the ones who are the poster children for the whole rest of the movement. We all have to admit that the really far out believers, sort of make us shake our heads and think, well, how could they possibly believe that? There might also be an element of humor involved with sort of critiquing, their particular beliefs. But a lot of that tends to get foregrounded and tends to represent the whole field. And that's why I think that if ufology is to really sort of pull itself up and establish a more serious face to the rest of the culture, the people who are, open-minded but appropriately skeptical really have to start taking a look at a lot of things and how they're done. And one of those things is really highlighting and drawing a more critical bit of attention to the people who are, I guess you might call the true believers. I think there's a bunch of other things, too, that ufology should do along those lines. I think there's a desperate need for some kind of really well-developed, attractive, easy-to-use database online that's maybe called something like whatufosarenot.com.
It's funny you mention that. A former guest, Ryan Mulley, he posted up on a Facebook page about UFOs that we needed to start something like this. This was just last week. And boy, I tell you, the comments came flooding in from everywhere. It was quite interesting to read all the comments. And it's kind of like I agree with you there, and I agree with his thoughts. But also the debate on who is the person to oversee this and who is the one to cull the wheat from the chaff and all that. And you can go on YouTube right now and find 50 hoaxes for every one very interesting, video. So I guess I do agree with that, but there's a lot of gray areas, and who would be admitting something like that? That's the tough part.
Yeah, I think that you've hit it right in the head. That would be a really challenging aspect to this, for sure.
We have just about four minutes left or so. So I'm going to ask you, have you read any other books besides the one you mentioned? Did you happen to read Leslie Keene's book, or are you familiar with her?
Yeah, I did. I read that UFOs, what's the subtitle to that? Pilots, Generals, etc.
Yes.
Go on the Record. That was a very interesting book. I appreciate the fact that she wrote it, but my main criticism of it was that it wasn't nearly as critical as it needed to be. Any UFO book that comes out that doesn't sort of anticipate the analytical demands of a proper investigation is going to be easily setting itself up for, being shot down. So my general critique of that book and a number of other UFO books I've read and podcasts I've heard and things I've read online is that there needs to be a really rigorous method of asking questions and applying doubt, not debunking dogmatic doubt, but trying to really find out the integrity of a person, the integrity of their perceptions, their judgment, and so forth. Just an approach that's more probing, critical, doubtful, rigorous, I think is in desperate demand at all times. And so that was my general read on that book. I appreciated that she wrote it, and there were a few things in there that I hadn't read about before, and I thought, wow, that's really interesting. I didn't know about that, and but I haven't had time to, pursue a lot of that. So it's one of those things you read and you sit it down and, let it roll about in your head for a while.
Yeah, I personally think that's one of the better books out there. Is there any other ones that you have read? We have just like a minute and a few seconds left. Any other books that you can think of that you read that were what you'd call a really good UFO book?
I'm scratching my memory to think of the title of it. It was one of Jacques Vallée's books. I was fairly impressed with.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what you think about Vallée, but he was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, he's one of the solid ones out there, in my opinion. You know, I don't know what the general ufology thinks of him, but I think it's pretty good. There's only something one time odd that I heard him say. Other than that, he's been pretty good. Well, we're coming down to about 30 seconds left, so I want to thank you very much for being on the show. And I usually ask people to give out their websites, but you're anonymous. So anyway, a real pleasure. And are you, you mentioned just a second ago that you listen to podcasts. Do you listen to other UFO podcasts out there, or have you?
The one I listen to most often is probably the Paracast.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of good guests on there, and they do a nice job. I like the Paracast, too, except for the commercials.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much, and I'll talk to you later. So that's it for the show today. If you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. Our guest next week is Undetermined. It's we have a couple people that are rolling around. We will come up with someone. And we'll be back next week. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Our guest, of course, Eric. Keith Rowland, producer for the Dark Matter Radio Network. Alejandro Rojas for the latest UFO news. Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music. Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember, for all the latest UFO news, astronomical news, you can like us on Facebook. You can check us out live right here next week on the Dark Matter Radio Network, and every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump in the chat room at podcastufo.com. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky, and we'll see you.